Okay, it's great to be back with everyone. As Shira was mentioning, I am a bit under the weather, but I think my voice should be okay. The bigger issue is that, or we should be thankful that there's a lot of strong winds and rain in Israel right now. And we've had a few power outages here over the last couple hours. Very brief power outages, but enough to knock out the internet for a couple of minutes. So that's why I have two screens on, which is hopefully a backup. But if I go out, I will come back on as soon as I can. Shira asked me what we should do in the meantime. Maybe say Tehillim. I don't know, actually. You'll improvise and we'll figure it out as we go along. Okay, so let's get started. As I mentioned last week, we're transitioning this week from issues related to from end of life and euthanasia to after a person has died or and posthumous organ donation. Now, this is a big and controversial issue in the particularly in the Orthodox Jewish community, but not only. In general, it's interesting why this might be, but Jews are underrepresented as organ donors relative to the rest of the population in most Western countries. Okay? Now, most countries don't keep track of organ donors by religion, so it's hard to know for sure what the statistics are, but we know from various sources and different places and different people that it seems clear that Jews, and not just Orthodox Jews, but Jews as a whole, are underrepresented as posthumous organ donors. This is in contrast to altruistic or live organ donors, which is, I'm sure you're aware of, or may be aware of. Jews, and in particular in this case Orthodox Jews, are leaders in the realm of kidney donation or altruistic donation, not just to family members, but to people that are not related to at all. Israel, the state of Israel, has the highest per capita rate of live kidney donation, and in general in the United States, a highly disproportionate number of the organ donors are Jews and religious Jews at that. But when it comes to posthumous organ donation, Jews are underrepresented, and we're going to address that tonight and try to understand, or today, and try to understand a bit of where this may or may not come from. I will put it out on the table, right, that I am an advocate of posthumous organ donation, of halachic organ donation. In fact, that the organization which I recently took over, although we're rebranding and renaming, was formerly known as the Halachic Organ Donor Society. And this is certainly something that we've been spoken about and publicized for the last 20 years. But I very much am interested in giving a clear and sort of, if you will, objective presentation on the topic, because I don't think anyone benefits from not giving clear and objective presentations on the topic. I very much believe in that. And to understand where what the real issues are, which, and I think there are real issues, although there are certainly issues that can be overcome, and the superstitions or myths that prevent organ donation. And this certainly is the case in many different times where it's not the issue that you think it is that's serving as an impediment for someone to donate organs. So it's important to understand what the real issues are and what to understand that I think the not real issues are. And next week, just to give you a preview, we're going to be talking about new frontiers in organ donation, because while everything we're going to say tonight is certainly remains relevant, I will try to show you the next week that the way science is doing today in terms of the process of dying is changing the face of what organ donation looks like, certainly in the West and beyond. We started talking about this a little bit last week as well, because I think I mentioned to you that in countries which allow euthanasia, so they're also doing euthanasia organ donation, which means that the person says, right, I want to have euthanasia or have mercy killing, but right, as soon as I die, I want this to be done in a controlled manner, so that way you can also retrieve my organs and give them to someone else. Okay? This is going on in the countries, European countries, and in Canada in particular, where they have euthanasia organ donation. Okay, so this is a very much related issue, but in order to understand some of the background here. From the get-go, I want to understand, focus today on what has classically been the important issue regarding organization and continues to be and will continue to be a major issue as well. All right, let me try to put my screen here. And okay, so here you have a picture of a famous moment, 1968, South African Dr. Christian Barnard, who is the famous for doing the first heart transplant. This was a matter of some controversy at the time, where some of the controversy related to his methods and how he did this and his personality and flamboyant, whatever it might be. But more fundamentally, it did relate to just the broader question of, well, you know, is the person who he, oops, sorry, I'm trying to control this, is the person who they were doing the transplant from, was he actually dead at the time? Okay, this issue of defining the moment of death has been a critical one. And let's explain why, although we're going to see a little bit next week why this is going to get fudged. In general, the principle has always been that we have something called the dead donor rule. The dead donor rule means that when you do organ transplantation, you don't retrieve organs from someone, right, unless they are actually dead. Okay. Now, this is important to note because it might seem obvious, but as we're going to see next week, it's not so obvious. But this was classically one of the questions. And basically the issue becomes is, well, when do you know a person is dead? So historically, this was not that big of a debate or question to worry about, because we sort of, you know when you see it, and in general, the body sort of fell apart and the various parts of the body stopped operating, stopped working together. So the heart and the lungs and whatnot would pretty much trigger a process in which people would die, and all their body, excuse me, would cease functioning in a relatively short period of time. Now, this has become complicated, and it's become complicated in the following manner. Scientific innovation, technology, can make dying not be a moment anymore, but a process. I want to explain what I mean by that. Organisms stop functioning, any organism, not just the human being. They stop functioning in a certain manner, and usually it triggers one thing from another, but there might be a possibility in which you say, well, at what point in the organism's dysfunction, what point in that process do you say, okay, we're drawing a line and this organism has died? Now, many times this doesn't really matter. So, if you have an ant, right? Does it really matter when an ant dies or doesn't die? Right? If ants get stepped on, right? Does it really matter? Not really, right? Probably doesn't have so much consequence. But when it comes to human beings, of course, it has a lot of implications. We know this in halacha, for example, the clearest implication of a person dying is tuma and tahara. Right? If a person dies in a room, so the room is tuma, right? Impurity gets spread. And so there seems to be a terminus. There seems to be a point at which people die in halacha, but in general also. Now, what's happened in 20th century medicine is that this process of dying, which isn't really a moment per se, but it's a process, can be stopped or slowed down, or it can be seized at a certain point. And then the question becomes, along that process of dying, when do you declare there to be a moment of death? This isn't a scientific point. And what I mean by that is as follows. Science can tell us, right, has the heart stopped? Has breathing stopped? Has other brain functioning stopped? Right, different things, what has stopped? And key point, of course, being irreversibly stopped. Science can tell us that. Medicine can tell us that. But where along the line, where along the process of dying do you declare death has occurred is not a scientific declaration. It's a moral one. It's a religious one. It's ethical. It's legal. It's cultural, whatever you want to call it. But there are different factors that are going on to society in which people say, okay, this point is when we say a person has died. Right? This is a point when a person has crossed it, the threshold of death. And it's not obvious when that is. For example, many countries, let's just say many countries anymore, but there are certain countries that are very hesitant to say that if a person has any form of signs of motion, such as a heart beating, right? And that their minds, there's no doubt the person is still alive. Even though they might have irreversible cessation of respiration, they'll never breathe again on their own. They're not moving, they're not functioning, not responsive. But for various cultural reasons or religious or ethical reasons, right, they won't say a person is dead. Now, this is an interesting conversation, but the question is why it becomes important. And it becomes important because starting in the 50s, a little before, but in the 50s and 60s, right, doctors developed the means of retrieving organs to take them from a person who's otherwise not living, but the organs, not the organism, but the organs are functional, and we can transplant that from one person to another person and save their life. And so then it becomes very critical now, when do you declare the moment of death in this process of dying? Death is the process, but when is the legal moment of death? Because if you're going to respect the dead donor rule, that means that you cannot extract, right? Cannot retrieve an organ from someone who's alive. If you're taking an organ from someone who's alive, then you might argue that you're killing that person. And this is part of the controversy already from the get-go in organ transplantation in general. But, you know, for various reasons, cultural and otherwise, the heart was very significant. And so while organ transplants are already going on in the 50s, livers, I think Pittsburgh was a critical place in the 1954, if not mistaken. But the heart and the significance of the heart was very important in 1968 with his first transplant, raising the question of, okay, well, is this person who they've taken, retrieved the organ from, truly dead? Now, just to put something out there from the get-go, there are cases in the world today where people are being murdered, killed for the sake of taking their organs, okay? And this is not just a theoretical conversation, right? And if you look and has been well documented at this point, that there are definitely political prisoners in China who are Falun Gong and others who are being killed for the sake of organ transplantation. If you do a Google search for Professor Jay Lavi, who's an Israeli, yes, this criminal is done for profit. Yes, of course it is, right? As someone puts in the notes. But if you look, do a Google search of Jay Lavi, you'll see that he discovered this phenomenon when one of his patients in Israel, in Tel Aviv, came to him and said, I'm getting a heart in 3 weeks. And Jay says to the guy, like, it's not how it works. You have to wait for someone to die. I said, no, I have it all set up. I'm going to China. My insurance is paying for it. Anyway, Jay did a lot of research into this and sort of exposed and discovered what was going on, and unfortunately still is going on in China today. And so it's clear that everyone agrees is highly, highly problematic, right? But those are cases where you have political prisoners who are fully alive and just being killed in order to take their organ, right? In this case, we have a genuine medical debate. No one here is murderers or killers or anything along these lines of people trying to understand, A, for its own sake, when is the moment of death? And B, particularly becomes important because of the question of organ transplantation. In general, the numbers around the world of people who could use an organ in order to live are staggering. Now, this is how it's always been in some cases, right? Organs dysfunction. But now that we have this technology and innovation that allows for us to take organs that would otherwise just decompose in the ground and use it to save someone's life, it's a very tempting and very powerful opportunity. So, for example, in the United States alone, about 17 to 21 people, depends on the year, die each day waiting for an organ. Okay. Right? So we're talking about 105, 110,000 people in the United States alone who are waiting for who could use an organ and will die without getting an organ. The vast majority of them are waiting for kidneys, need kidneys, but of course there are others as well. There's lungs, livers, pancreas, small intestines, and so on. Cornea also is very relevant. And there are various other things that are being transplanted today, but I'm talking now in particular about life-saving organs. Okay, so this is a crucial issue, and it's a crucial issue in general around the world. In the state of Israel, of course, this is a big issue because if Jews don't donate organs, then there aren't going to be any organs to be had, right? It's not one of those cases, which isn't our topic, right? But there's a little bit of a parallel here to issues related to, like, let's say, donating bodies to science. In times when there was a shortage or the need for bodies to be used, this was a question, could Jews donate their bodies to science? And it's very critical. That's not our topic for today, but in places like Canada, America, England, there are other people that are donating organs, and organs have to be had, although that raises other issues that will come up. But in the state of Israel, if there aren't organs to be donated, then anyone who needs an organ in Israel will die. And so that's why it became a particularly acute issue, and is one of the reasons why this got pushed to the forefront. Now, the state of Israel has a relatively low rate of posthumous organ donors. And let we know now the statistics already from 2022, it was about 55 to 56% of the people who could donate, who were declared brain dead, decided to donate. Now, let's explain what this means. Brain death is defined as the irreversible cessation of respiration. Okay? In Israel, they actually don't call it brain death. And brain death in some ways is a misnomer, because when you call brain death, you think that, like, everything in the brain isn't functioning anymore. There's no cellular activity or whatnot. But what we really care about brain death is really known as brain stem death. And particularly when we're talking about brain stem death, we're talking about the parts of the brain that control the nervous system that's connected to respiration. In Israel, they actually call it respiratory brain death, because the key point is that the person is not responsive to their environment, and there's irreversible cessation of respiration. Okay, that's what we care about here. That's why it's called in Israel respiratory brain death. And the question is, right, is this considered to be death? And this is an amazing phenomenon that doesn't happen that often. It's important to understand why. Most of the time when people die, so they die after cardiac death, right, that their heart has stopped. And once the heart has stopped, so we're going to complicate this a bit next week, but traditionally speaking, once the heart has stopped, so there's no circulation, there aren't that going to be organs to be retrieved. Maybe a cornea can be used, maybe some blood vessels, but organs aren't going to be around. Brain death happens in a unique circumstance where a person stops breathing, right? They're not responsive to the outside world, and they've stopped breathing, but they are attached to a ventilator. And the ventilator keeps air circulating enough to keep the blood flowing as well, long enough to keep the organs, not the organism, but the organs functioning long enough to be retrieved. And most of the time, the heart and other organs will stop functioning within 24 hours, an average 3 days, sometimes longer. But no one's ever woken up, so to speak, from brain death. It's not a case of PVS, a vegetative state, not a coma. Something very different, the irreversible cessation of respiration. And the question is this considered to be death? It doesn't happen that often. So in the state of Israel, in the average year, about 450 people are declared dead by the neurological criteria, by respiratory brain death. But only 180 of those 450 have organs which are in the physical condition that can be retrieved. So many times, even if there's brain death and brain death has been declared, the organs, because of the condition of the body, because of the health history of the person, they can't retrieve the organs in those cases. So it doesn't happen that often, which is why it's so critical when it does happen to see if we can retrieve those organs. Now, I'm going to show you the halachic debate here, but people I see in the chat already starting to ask, well, do we care about what the soul is? Maybe the heart is the seat of the soul and all these questions. Okay. So, and maybe the brain. Right? So I want to explain this. This is a misconception. This has nothing to do with metaphysics. Okay. This has nothing to do with when does the soul enter the body or leave the body. And sometimes I hear rabbis, say things like, This is a great debate. Halacha, is the brain what matters in life, or is the heart what matters in life? Is it the lev or the moach? Are we emotional people? Are we irrational people? This is all narishkeit. Okay, this is total misunderstanding of the debate. We are talking about, I hate to use the term narishkeit, but it upsets me when even rabbis like mistake like what the debate's about. This is a very fundamental question, not metaphysical, but functional. Do we say that once a person has irreversible functioning of this critical part of their existence, breathing, irreversible cessation of breathing, is that the halachic criteria for death or not? Okay. Now, people ask what happens to the soul. I don't know what happens to the soul. When does the soul depart? All this, we don't know, right? It's not really part of this debate. It's much more about questions of the functioning of the body. Now, in Israel, and this is true in general, and this is sort of tragic in some ways, but this is some ways in Israel become, we'll discuss, of course, the answer in a moment, but this is in some ways become a Haredi versus religious Zionist debate. So the great Haredi poskim, Zichronam Levracha, Zichron Tzadik Tzadikim Levracha, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashiv were asked about this issue. And there's a whole history to this question, and there are conversations about it, there are statements about it. But both Rav Eliashiv and Rav Orbach ruled that it is asur, is forbidden for a person to donate organs because of the belief that this might not fulfill the criteria of halachic death. There's a difference between Rav Eliashiv's position on this and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's position on this. And there's a whole history here, which I don't think we can get into right now. But in practice, both of them ruled that you cannot donate. Now, you might be ask yourself momentarily, is that that's the case? Well, maybe this also means that you cannot receive organs as well, because if you're in the state of Israel, who are you getting the organs from? So in fact, Rav Orbach was very consistent. Rav Orbach felt in the state of Israel, this is brought down the Sefer Nishmat Abraham, you cannot receive organs as well. Shlomo Zalman in the state of Israel, he said it's not a chutz laretz, we'll get back to that momentarily. Rav Shlomo Zalman felt that we don't think this is death. You can't support a country having a system of brain death, right? We just don't hold of this, so to speak. Rav Eliashiv, for various reasons, felt differently and felt you could still receive, partly because he felt that they're going to declare the person dead anyway. But according to both of them, you cannot donate organs, okay? Which is why in the state of Israel, you more or less won't find any Haredim who will donate posthumously organs. Okay, they don't donate organs posthumously. And this is one of the factors, of course, that pushes down Israel's donation rate, because the Haredim make up a non-insignificant population, part of the population. There are other ethnic and religious groups in Israel, including some Arab and Muslim groups that also have various hesitations about brain death, and they too traditionally don't donate, though there's been some progress with them as well. And so that is one of the reasons why Israel has a relatively lower rate. We've improved this. I mean, it used to be much lower. Now it's about 55%. But, you know, if you don't have the Haredim donating and you don't have large portions of the Arab and Muslim population donating, you're already handicapped, right, in your numbers from the get-go. Right now, I say this is tragic in many ways that this became a Haredi versus religious Zionist debate. And we're going to see coming up in a bit about the religious Zionist position on this. But it's tragic, partly because there are and were Haredi poskim who are sympathetic to this idea of saying that brainstem death is the halachic definition of death. And the most critical one of which, of course, is Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein is not a religious Zionist in many, many great traits, but he wasn't a religious Zionist. And of course, there's the Gadol Ador, and a very significant figure, dies in 1986. And already in 1976, Rav Moshe seems to make pretty clear in a tshuva that he writes to his son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, and he makes it very clear that he accepts the respiratory definition, respiratory brain death as a halacha criteria of death. Okay. And we're going to see coming up exactly a little bit where this debate comes from. But that seemed to be his position and was affirmed by his sons, including Rav David Feinstein, of course, the son-in-law, of three or four doctors that also spoke to him about this, who said he ruled this lemaaseh, and that, you know, should have been his ruling, and that should have had a lot of weight. For various reasons, which I don't fully understand, I mean, I don't really want to speculate so much, but for various reasons, doubts have been cast upon this tradition of Rav Moshe Feinstein affirming brain death as death. I can't think of any example in which we have a written psak of a posek that was affirmed by his sons and son-in-laws and was affirmed by three or four doctors who spoke to him about it. And he gave a position. And somehow this position has been put into doubt, cast into doubt. I can't think of any other example like this in halachic literature. Maybe you can ask Mark Shapiro, if you take his class, if you can think of an example like this. But in any case, but that is the reality. But Rav Moshe Feinstein's position was very influential, and so influential in particular with the religious Zionist community. And so when the chief rabbis of Israel had to make a decision on this question, they partly relying on Rav Moshe Feinstein, but in 1986, it's already, this is Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Abraham Shapiro, and others accepted brain death criteria. Okay. And this is very fascinating because, you know, religious Zionist rabbis, we don't agree about a lot of things, right? So let me just try to pull this up here. You can see a little better. So religious Zionist rabbis, they argue about Geirut standards. They're about Kashrut standards. They argue about Shemitah standards. We argue about all sorts of things. I mean, what bracha do you make on Bamba, right? The national food in Israel? Answer, it's a machloket, right? Everything we argue about. There's one issue and one issue alone, which religious Zionists poskim, right? Throughout the spectrum of religious Zionism, whatever flavor of religious Zionism you want, accept and agree upon. And that is this question of the respiratory brain death is the criteria, halacha criteria for death, right? And therefore, organ donation is permissible, not just permissible, but a mitzvah. And you can see here, right, the various statements have been put out by the religious Zionist rabbinate over the years. So where does this debate come from, right? Where does this sort of, where does the heart of this question come from? So I want to show you now, well, argue are three things, factors that I think is fair to say that these are not the real factors, not the real not the real barriers to organ donation. There are sort of more myths than anything else. And then I want to show you what I think is the real issue and where the real debate stems from. Let me just try to pull this back up. Here we go. So this is what I call the set. The set. Yeah, the set of issues, which I think are surmountable barriers, okay? Set stands for superstitions, emotions, and three isurim, or the triad of taboos, whatever you feel like you want to just call P. Okay, now superstitions, there are two superstitions that are relevant here. One is the issue of tchiyat hametim. I don't mean belief in tchiyat hametim. I mean that if you believe in tchiyat hametim, which is a fundamental of Jewish faith, that if you donate your organs, this will prevent you from having your life resurrected at the period of Tchiyat HaMetim, okay? I can't tell you how many people believe this, right? This is actually a real thing that people cite. And, you know, I hate to break it to people, but as I'm sure you're aware of the fact that bodies decompose. So people's organs decompose, and therefore, when God has the power and wills it to bring back the people back to life, he's going to find a way to bring back people's organs and to make him even more serious. Would anyone suggest, right, that someone who was cremated during the Holocaust isn't going to be brought back during Tchiyat HaMetim, even though their organs have been cremated, right? So it's one of those things which is important to just clarify, and that's not really an issue. Sometimes people also say, oh, I can't sign an organ donor card or express my wishes on that, because that's like an ayin hara, evil eye. And, you know, I always ask people, well, do you have life insurance? Do you sign a ketubah, a divorce document, right? Do you have fire insurance? Do you have health insurance, right? A lot of other things. This is not a real barrier, but it is one of those cultural phenomena that people make people nervous about organ donation. There's another factor, of course, which is emotions, right? The E here. And that, of course, is very understandable because, you know, remember what I said beforehand, many times the way the conditions in which organ donation take place is when someone dies suddenly. It could be a car crash, it could be a bike accident, it could be a brain aneurysm, it could be an overdose, sometimes accidental, sometimes not, right? In these circumstances, and so suddenly one morning you wake up, and this is not like after like a protracted case of extended mouth cancer, right? And so Sunday one morning, you, a normal day, and by the end of the day, you're dealing with a loved one who's died, and you know, all of a sudden the doctors come in and they tell you this term you've never heard of called brain death. And then they say he's dead, even though the heart's beating, the body still feels warm, which is something which is hard to grasp if you haven't thought about it beforehand. And then they say, we like to retrieve their organs. That's emotionally very difficult to handle. And we've had cases, you know, in Hodes and other circumstances where we've had to walk people through that process, especially if you've never been educated about organ donation beforehand. That's a sort of a shock to the system. So there's no doubt that the superstitions are very surmountable. The emotions, of course, are difficult, but I think that's also surmountable. And then there's these issues of the three isurim, of desecrating the body, of delaying burial, and of deriving benefit, of hana'a, halanat metim, and nivul hamet. Now, all of these are very serious prohibitions. And if we were talking, for example, about the question of autopsies or medical research, donated by the science, these would be much more relevant to the conversation. But in this case of organ donation, it's really not relevant because while these are serious isurim, which we normally take quite seriously, they're all pushed aside for pikuach nefesh, you're saving life. Right, so pikuach nefesh pushes aside those isurim. Now, culturally speaking, you should know, particularly in the non-Orthodox world, but Orthodox world as well, but certainly non-Orthodox world, the issue of bodily integrity is a major barrier for people donating. Right? It's a major barrier for people donating, and so you'll have cases all the time where people say, "Listen, Jews, we don't donate. Why don't we donate?" They're asked, because we think the body has to be buried whole. Right. So I had a colleague who was once dealing with a case of organ donation of a man who was totally, totally not observant, and it was very obvious wasn't observant, not affiliated, tattoos, the whole thing. And he tells my colleague, "Listen, we just can't donate organs. Jews don't do this." And the rabbi is saying to him, "I think we can. Why do you feel this way?" And he says to him, "Jews have to be buried whole." And he says to him, "Well, why do you believe this? So Jews have to be buried whole. Yes, that's true, but not always when you can save a life with those organs." I mean, so, and the guy says to him, "Listen, Rabbi, when my grandfather had to have the bottom part of his leg amputated, we kept it in the freezer for 12 years in my house until he was buried. And so if his leg had to be buried and kept in my freezer for 12 years, there's no way I'm going to donate organs." And the rabbi more or less looked at him and said, "All right, you know, if that was your experience, there's not much I can do about that." Right? So, and it would be a funny story if it wasn't for the fact that it meant also in this case, three or four lives weren't saved because of this misconception. So it's a major barrier, this idea. And it's important to keep in mind, right, that yes, it's true, Jews believe in burying the body whole, but not when it's not a barrier to saving people's lives. And if, by the way, it should be a case where one of the organs was retrieved and then wasn't able to be used for whatever reason, it wasn't deemed healthy enough, so that organ should be given back to the family, it should be buried with the body. I mean, we had a case like this previous December, December 2021, where a young boy died and four organs were donated and four lives were saved. There was a fifth organ retrieved and the other organ wasn't healthy enough, and they buried it with him, right, at that time, and Chevra Kedisha handled it, right? So, you know, these are serious issues, but they do not override the issue of Pikuach Nefesh. The biggest barrier, the genuinely serious, significant question when it comes to organ donation is, do we actually consider this person to be halachically dead? That's a real significant question. And keep this in the back of your mind also for when we talk about this next week as well, because we're going to complicate the conversation. But that's a genuine question which everyone should ask. I mean, it's one of these questions about the nature of science and technology. And I think very much that the whole issue of posthumous organ donation should be framed in those terms. Here we have an incredibly powerful new tool, okay, which we'll call, it's a part of a toolbox in many ways, right, that can keep a person respirated through a ventilator, right, and keep the heart pumping for a short period of time, right, but the body feels warm. There's a heartbeat, right, there's oxygen as there's oxygen going through this person's body. Is the fact that they are non-responsive to their environment and will never, ever be able to breathe again on their own, this irreversible cessation of respiration, is this sufficient for halacha to declare this person dead? Okay. Now, the essential problem that comes up here is, what precedent are you going to come with, up with, and cite in halacha to deal with this case? Because it just wasn't a reality that Poskim had to deal with, because it wasn't a reality that medicine made possible, right? It just wasn't an issue that people had to have to deal with over the centuries. Okay, so I want to show you what I think is cited as the classic source on this issue, even though, you know, it's not a perfect source, but it's certainly the classic source. Okay, and this is the source in the Gemara and Yuma Daf. excuse me, Peihei, and the Gemara here is discussing the following. A person has been buried under a collapsed building. There's an earthquake, right? Lo aleinu, we have this down in Turkey, right? So there's an earthquake, and a person's been buried under a collapsed building. Under what, and it's Shabbat. Under what point do you keep on checking to see if they're alive? And what the Gemara says, and there's a whole discussion here about what this is, which I don't want to get too into because it can confuse things a bit, but what the Gemara clearly concludes, and what is concluded in Shulchan Aruch as well, this is a clear, universally accepted psak halacha, is you check to the nose. You do the feather test. Now, it's interesting. What are they looking for when they do the feather test? Right? What's the purpose of that? Well, A, the person is not responsive, and B, it seems clear that you are testing to see if there's still respiration, okay? And that seems clear what the Gemara is looking for. And the question is, though, is just why do we care about respiration? Now, it's interesting, the Gemara gives an explanation, and it says as follows, that the dispute about how far you go, is it up to the navel, maybe even the heart? I'm not getting to the heart here for other reasons. We'll see why it's confusing. Come back to it. But with the clear answer, the Gemara is what we care about is the nose. And the Gemara says we care about the nose because the nose is where life began. As we learn in Sefer Bereishit, all right, the Nefesh Chaya, right, that God brings in a breath of the spirit of life through the nostrils. Okay. So this is interesting because what does the Gemara tell us here? If you want to test to see if the person is dead, you test his nose. Why? Because that's where life began. Is this Gemara also not just telling us how to test if we want to know we're not sure is the person dead or alive? Or is this Gemara not just telling us that, but is it giving us a criteria for what death is? Now, let me explain the difference between a test and a criteria. Right? In general, when we think about how to define death, right? So death is something, one thing that seems to be clear about what death is that's irreversible. We're going to make that complicate that a little bit next week. Maybe we'll talk about permanent, but it seems that one of the things that why, of course, death is so profound and difficult is it's irreversible. What needs to be irreversible to say that a person has died? Again, historically, this wasn't the question. So you might have a concept of what that means, of what it means to be alive. And then you say, well, I have a concept of what it means to be alive. I now have a concept to say of what it means for the person to be dead. You could have a criteria, which is, okay, well, I want to know is what's defining, right? What are the tools I'm going to use? Not tools so much as, but what is the, so we say we have the concept and you can have the criteria for death. And the criteria for death is going to be, well, I want to explain why would I say that this is the critical definition of what death is. And then you have a test. You have a test. Well, how do I know if that criteria was implemented, was met? Now, the Gemara only tells us a test, but does it also give us a concept or a criteria? And you could argue and say that when the Gemara, sorry, a little background here, you could say that when the Gemara tells us that the reason why we care about the test of the feather is because of breathing, maybe it's also giving us a respiratory criteria. And it's telling us that what makes a person alive is that they can breathe. They can't breathe on their own. They're unresponsive to the outside society, outside world, and they cannot ever, again, breathe on their own. This is death. This is the machloket. And so some poskim want to say, based on this Gemara, and this seems to be what Rav Moshe Feinstein was saying, and others, that basically it's not just a test. It's a criteria. The Gemara was giving us here a criteria for death. And it was saying that what we care about is respiration, and the irreversible cessation of respiration is what defines death. But others would say, and I legitimately say, believe you could read the Gemara this way. There's no broader criteria being given here. There wasn't a bigger statement. What was the case of the Gemara? The person is buried. There's an avalanche. We don't know. How do we test? We test. Because if we don't see any other signs of life, we test the nose, and that's how we know. But if there are other signs of life, then I don't use the breathing test. In other words, what other poskim say, and you can see this in the writing of Rav Vosner, various Haredi poskim in Israel, basically says, listen, once you have other signs of life, those other signs of life are discount the breathing test. So there's a real question here of, did the Gemara give us a criteria and say we care about the respiratory criteria and respiratory brain death? The irreversible cessation of respiration is the halachic criterion of death. Or is the Gemara just giving us a test of no other signs of life? But if you feel heart beating, and if you see other signs of life, well, then we don't care about respiration. The person is alive. I think that's actually a genuinely interesting and fair debate about what to read from this Gemara. But here's my only issue. You got to go both ways. So if you think, as the religious Zionist poskim, the chief rabbi of Israel, and by the way, it's not just religious Zionist poskim, meaning there are certain poskim that are sort of on the borders of the religious Zionist world. Rav Shlomo Amar, now the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, former Rishon LeZion, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, and others, right, who also accept respiratory brain death and permit organ donation. But if you think that that's death, and therefore we can donate organs, I fully get it. You can donate and you can receive, because that's what death is. Now, if you think that this is not the Jewish criteria for death, you just don't believe it. You think as long as the heart's beating, the person's alive. But I find that to be totally cogent. I don't find it compelling, but it's a fair way of thinking about these issues. What I have a lot harder time understanding is, if you think the person's alive because their heart is still beating, how can you benefit and take their organs? Meaning it's one or the other. If they're dead, you can do organ donation. If they're not dead, you can't do organ donation. And the same way in which we say that we cannot take organs in China from the Falun Gong, right, or be killed, so too, we should not be taking organs after brain death. That would make perfect sense to me. What I find harder to understand is the position which says that, well, you can't donate organs, but you can receive organs. And the argument that they give for this is that, well, the person's going to be declared dead anyway, and or it's the doctors that are taking the organs, not you. And so some things along these lines. And I find that to be a very hard argument to understand. First of all, let's just make sure we understand how organ donation works. When you want to be an organ recipient, you have to sign up, right? It's not like, you know, like you randomly find you, right? You have to sign up in order to be on the list. The list is a very long list. A lot of people waiting on this list, and they give it based on criteria, starting with usually about one of the obvious first criteria is how badly do you need it? Meaning if you're going to die sooner without this organ, then you're going to be bumped up the list, right? So when you put yourself on the list, you are encouraging the whole process of accepting brain death and an organ donation. Moreover, when they retrieve the organ for you, the doctors are doing it for you, right? They're not just doing it in general. It's not like a skin bank. It doesn't work like a skin bank. You know, we can save it for a couple of months or whatever it might be, right? Organ retrieval is a highly time sensitive and orchestrated process. It doesn't always work, right? You've got to get we've gotten a lot better at it. The technology has improved a lot now. So we can transport organs from different places and far away. I think a couple of years ago, they started using a drone actually, which is super cool, right? To transport, an organ, which is pretty wild, right? But it's a highly orchestrated process where we got to get the recipient into the OR as soon as possible, get them ready, and then we try to retrieve the organ because the organ can only survive so long. The doctors are doing this for you. So if you're a recipient, you're part of this process. So I have a hard time understanding the justification for it. But, I get it. People want to live, and the truth is I want everyone to take organs. I believe that if you're going to take organs, you should also be willing to donate organs. And this is, interestingly enough, has actually been the approach that's been taken by the Beis Din of Sydney, which is led by a couple of very senior Chabad Dayanim, Rav Gutnick and Rav Ullman, and also the position of the Beis Din in Johannesburg, who basically said, listen, we're not going to be able to resolve this rabbinic discussion debate on this. But if you want to donate, we're going to give you full support, right? And what they're basically coming and doing and saying is, once we have a system where our community is going to receive organs, which they should, right? So too, you should be able to donate organs as well, and we'll support you and provide supervision for this as well, okay? Which is, in my mind, a very reasonable way of approaching this issue. But that's where the debate is. And so I'm going to take questions right now, but I'll just sum up where basically you have a fundamental disagreement. The issue is not about Tchiyat HaMetim or Nivul HaMet or desecration. All these things are certainly overcomable. The fundamental question is, does Halacha recognize respiratory brain death as a criteria for death? The Gemara tells us it's the test for death. But when it told us it's a test for death, did it also establish a criteria for death? And what's unfortunately happened is that in Israel, like I said, it became a religious Zionist versus Haredi issue. And I have all sorts of reasons why I speculate why all religious Zionists both have accepted it. And in Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora, which is influenced by different factors, so it became a very big debate and a big disagreement, highly politicized and highly personal in some ways. And that's unfortunate. And so, I'm trying to lower the flames and the heat on that debate, but it's important for us to think about it, about this profound issue. Okay, let me open up some questions here and some comments. Moshe Broner mentions that he belongs to the Halachic Organ Donor Society. Yes, so do I. I'm the executive director of it, in fact. So I'm in favor of that. But thank you for mentioning the organization as well. Although we're rebranding into Amatai, as you can see in the background here. Okay, let me open up to some questions while I read the chat. Shira, I don't know if you're still with us, but if someone wants to raise your hand or whatever it might be, we'll take it that way as well. I can't see. Let me pull open here.
So could I ask a question or are you still?
Go ahead, Richard. Yeah.
So the people who do not accept the respiratory issue as a criteria, so they need to supply some other criteria and to justify why that one is the correct one. And I haven't seen that response, really.
Yeah, so it's an interesting question you're raising. Presumably, not they would advocate for some form of cardiac or cardiological definition of death, which is also a little bit complicated, though, because, first of all, where in halacha does that come from?
Right, that was my question. Like, what's the basis for choosing cardiac? I mean, sick ratio goes, I mean, there's clearly evidence against that.
Yeah, so I'd say that the best evidence for it is just what the historical practice always was. This is partly an issue, right? And the historical practice is what everyone in the world did. Of course, that's all that existed historically.
No one knew.
So, right. So now it wasn't just no one knew. It was also it wasn't possible.
Right. No.
Okay? Yeah. So and so part of what's going on in this issue is the. But it's only part of the conversation is the willingness to utilize science and accept scientific innovation to impact the way we think about halacha. It's not a coincidence that one of the major faces for the integration of science and Torah in the United States is Rabbi Tendler, Zatzal. And it's not a coincidence that Rabbi Tendler was very much an advocate for the respiratory brain death. I mean, that was part of his vision. Now, I'm not saying you can't care about science and Torah and think about that, and that means you have to accept that. I'm not saying that. But it's not a coincidence that someone like Rabbi Tendler would be pushing for that definition. But we're going to see next week. It's going to become even the whole cardiac definition is becoming even more and more complicated because of new innovations. But we'll get to that more next week. Nikki.
Correct me if I'm mistaken, but is it true that in Israel, if you donate a kidney and later on in life you need a kidney, you go to the top of the list?
And yeah. So
is that true in America as well? And if it's not, which I don't think it is, do you think that would improve the problem?
Well, listen. Encouraging altruistic kidney donation or live kidney donation should be a real priority in any healthcare system. And the reason is that even if everyone who's declared brain dead and they had kidneys to donate would donate their kidneys, we'd still need more kidneys. I mean, the shortage of kidneys is only growing in part because of people's health habits and eating habits, and other factors. So we need to find ways of encouraging kidney donation in general. Just, we have to understand that kidney donation, even when people do it altruistically, usually you do it within your tribe, so to speak, within your people. I'm not being critical of that in any sense. I would love to see every faith community encourage their members to donate kidneys to their faith community or to your region or to your neighborhood or whatever it might be. Those are models which Jews have actually done incredibly well right now. And I'd like to see that encouraged other places. In Israel, there are two interesting incentives that are done in order to encourage organization. One is what you mentioned beforehand, that if you're a kidney donor and then later on need a kidney, you will be bumped up on the list. And the second thing is that in the algorithm, if you sign up to be a kidney donor, I mean, you sign your organ donor card, you will also be prioritized in a certain respect to the algorithm. And all those factors have helped a little bit in Israel, But I don't think that's really the key to push it over. Meaning the fact that there's altruistic donation is been critical. That's a huge, huge factor. And more should be done for that, at least with regard to kidney or for that matter, for the liver lobes. And the question, most of this has to do with just education in general. I mean, education is critical. You should know that in Europe, many European countries have now switched to what's known as an opt-out system, which means the default is you are an organ donor unless you decide not to be in the system. You opt out. It's not clear that that actually is an effective technique, if it actually works better. And a lot of American and Canadian feel that they're actually counterproductive, because they feel that societies that promote individualism, people don't go for that. They don't like that. So it's hard to know if that's actually successful, but that's another type of move that people have made to try to encourage it. Let's see, who else? Hedda Silverstein.
Oh, it's Hedda. Yes, I was just thinking, is there an age where you no longer, the doctors would no longer take any organs? You know, as you go, as so many people live into their 80s, 90s or more.
So, great question. It used to be that we would say this is a young person's business. That's no longer the case. And we'll take organs today. What really matters is the health history and condition of the person. There are definitely cases of posthumous organ donation, people in their 70s. It doesn't happen every day, right? But it definitely is possible. And there are cases where someone's, 40 and they can donate. I mean, I had this case earlier this year. We got a call. It doesn't matter all the details here, but it was a case of someone who died in their early 40s and they wanted to donate. And I was explaining to what to do, but then it turned out that the person had cancer previously, and even though they're in remission, but because of the fear that there still be cancerous tissue, that they wouldn't do the organ donation in that case. And all these are interesting questions about what, how to test for, to figure out which organs and when organs should be done. There's a very big fight in general between the organ procurement organizations and the transplant centers about what makes a sufficiently healthy organ, an organ sufficiently healthy in order to use it for transplantation. If you look in the letter section of the New York Times a couple of days ago, there's a big blow up about this issue, because in general, there's a lot of criticism of the organ donor system as a whole. And the question is what can be done to utilize more retrievable organs for donation? It's very difficult. It's a very sensitive question, because you don't want to transplant an organ that's not healthy to someone else. You're not doing anyone a favor there, obviously. But the question becomes, when is it sufficiently healthy? How do you draw the line there? And that's a big debate. Next question. Let me just see here. I'm trying to look in the chat. So Daria brings up the question of human dignity in a cultural perspective. Listen, there's no doubt you're right. I mean, it's interesting. Japan has a very low organ donor rate. It's gone up, but for various cultural reasons, Japanese don't buy this idea of concept of organ donation. And by the way, I don't really have a problem with that per se. Meaning there's a famous Jewish philosopher named Hans Jonas, who was a survivor, a very interesting figure and a very interesting thinker about questions of technology. And he basically said in the 60s already, don't go down the road of organ donation. You're going to ruin, right, this whole concept of human dignity. And ultimately, you're going to violate our beliefs, in human dignity through this process. And, it's an interesting argument. We'll come up again next week. But society, Western societies for sure, but not only have decided otherwise, right? The ability of, it's a tremendous, and they've looked at it as follows. And this is the way I think about it a lot. Our organs are going to decompose. That's just the way it works. And it's a tremendous, like, miracle from God to have the opportunity to have one last mitzvah, which is really a chesed shel emet. You're not going to benefit from it at all. Right? We used to think of chesed shel emet as people burying you, but here's one last opportunity of a chesed shel emet in which your organs, which are going to decompose, can give the gift of life to someone else. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling. It's such like an incredible miracle that we live in these times where that's possible. So, you know, I find it to be a tremendous source of strength and affirmation of human dignity, but I can understand how people can see otherwise. I also add, as I look at some of the questions here, that it's a tremendous source of nechama, of comfort to families if they can donate organs. And this is something which I stress to a lot of rabbis when they're on the fence on this issue. I say, listen, you can debate this back and forth as a machloket, but what you really need to do is look at the family that's asking you this shaila, this question, and understand what do they need now, this moment, right? Let's say we had a case here a few months ago, we're dealing with the 36-year-old who had a brain aneurysm and just, you know, and died. He's playing basketball one day and dies the next day. And it's a family, he's a member of a family of five kids, four of whom are married with children. And he was the fifth and single, not married, no kids. And he dies at the age of 36. And the hospital explains what happens and they do all the proper tests. And they asked him to donate. And at that moment, the family, one of the brothers actually says to the parents, this is the way in which our brother's life is going to go on. His legacy will continue. Now, he didn't have children, but he's going to save lives. And his organs are going to go on. And it was a tremendous, tremendous source of nechama, of comfort to the family. In his case, they donated six organs, corneas, and skin. That's a lot of lives being impacted by him. So it's a tremendous source of nechama and for them. And I've even had rabbis who've told me who don't hold of the brain death criteria, but they recognize it's a machloket and they're asked a question. And they said they could look at the family in the eye and they realized this would be tremendously helpful for the family and their comfort. It's something which I stress over and over again. It's really a very important factor to keep in mind. This is interesting. Someone asked, Joyce asked the question about, well, maybe we should be allowed to take one kidney. Right? In other words, even if you don't hold of brain death, you don't believe in that standard, you should take one kidney. The problem with that is as follows. First of all, let's understand something. Even after cardiac death, classically, you can donate cornea and you can donate blood vessels. Now, a lot of times people poo-poo this, like, that's nothing. I'm not saying it's the same thing as accepting brain death, but, you know, getting a cornea and getting back the vision that you once had or could have never had, whatever it might be, is unbelievable. I mean, I've been Hanukkah time. I was invited to light the Hanukkah at a Hanukkah party of organ donor families. And I was sitting there with someone whose son had been killed in one of the Tel Aviv terrorist attacks last year. I remember he's from Kfar Saba. I'm blanking on his name. He was in the bar. He gets shot from Kfar Saba in the bar in Tel Aviv. And his father, you know, donated his cornea. And, you know, that was tremendous. It was a tremendous thing for the family to receive, you know, the people that receive the cornea. But of course, it's not the same as, you know, as being able to give other things like heart, livers, lungs, and whatnot. And the problem is that if you don't hold of brain death, you can't really take someone's kidney because you're dealing with a goseth. You're dealing with someone who's clearly moribund, who's going to die soon. And so it becomes very hard to justify taking. Although I've discussed with some poskim who've said to me, you know, I'd give one, you know, allow people to take one kidney. I don't know. But, you know, as we're going to see next week, I think that the frontier of organ donation, the technology is changing now, where there might be some interesting new possibilities. And which is why I was stressing so much, the only barrier, true barrier, to halachic organ donation is it's when you feel there's a time of death, death has been passed. Because otherwise, there aren't barriers. And as the technology changes, and I think more and more organs are become retrievable, even after cardiac death, that might open the door for more and more Jews to donate posthumously. But that will come up a little more next week. And a couple more questions here. Yeah, someone asked how many people are eligible for organ donation per year. Not that many. It's just a very small percentage of deaths is in cases of brain death. Now, we'll discuss a little more next week or other situations where it's coming up, but it's not... it's not so many. That's why it's such an important issue. But, you know, by the way, I'd be curious, and you can email me if you want to. I'll put my email here as well. If you know of a case of someone, whether you, your family or a loved one or a friend or in your community, of someone who's Jewish who posthumously donated organs, I'd be very appreciative to hear about the story of the case, because we are a storytelling people. And what impacts people the most in anything is understanding the power of organ donation to save lives and the power of organ donation to offer nechama. So I grew up in a community in Houston where actually a woman down my block, it was so sad, a woman down my block had a brain issue. She goes to the hospital. They say, you're going to be fine, go out. My mom was making dinner for them that night, you know, coming back from the hospital. And she took her kids out to the zoo with her husband. And she had a brain aneurysm and died. And they donated. And they went to my father, Lava Shalom, who was a bioethicist, to ask him about it. And my father wisely called up Rabbi Tendler on the issue. Rabbi Tendler knew my father, and Rabbi Tendler goes, my father, you know how I feel about this. I know how you feel about this. Why are you calling me? And my father said to Rabbi Tendler, I think the family should talk to a rabbi. They'd appreciate that more. And they spoke to Rabbi Tendler. It's very powerful. And it was very powerful impact on the community. And my neighbor, then another person, the other side of my house, needed a heart transplant several years later, and he got one. And, you know, that was tremendous as well. So I think stories of Jews receiving and donating is really the most powerful way of spreading, you know, the, what I consider to be the mitzvah of organ donation. But so if you have such stories, you know, I'd be happy to hear about them and to share them. And I'll end with one final thought. And then you know, we'll pull it in for the day. There is a shita in Israeli poskim which says this is not a choice. Okay. Rav Ratzon Arusi is the Sephardic chief rabbi of Kiryat Ono. Very fascinating figure. Basically says, if halacha accepts brain death as the criteria for death, is what she does, he says, why are we giving people a choice? Right? Just, you don't own your body. You don't own the opportunity, right? What do you need the organs for? We should take them. And that gives people a choice. And he put this proposal out about 10 to 15 years ago, and it didn't go too far. And I'm happy it didn't go too far because I don't want the government sort of acting that way when it comes to organ retrieval. And I do think that there's something very powerful about people making a choice. And this is a very powerful choice which people should make and make that decision when it comes to what they feel should be done with their body. So I do think it's a matter of choice. But, you know, my own position, as I made clear, I think halacha does accept respiratory brain death as the criteria of brain death, and people should donate. We should hope and pray it doesn't come up, because in most cases that's coming up with sudden deaths. But if it does, you know, come up, we should be educated and aware of what the real issues are.
Who was that Sephardi rabbi? Could you give his name again? Who is that Sephardi rabbi who said you don't own your body?
Rabbi Ratzon Arusi. He's the Sephardic chief rabbi of Kiryat Ono. Arusi, A-R-U-S-S-Y.
Where is Kiryat Ono? Where is that?
It's near Tel Aviv, near the Tel Aviv area in here in Israel. And he's an influential rabbi in general. I mean, he's a very interesting figure. He was almost the Sephardic chief rabbi at one point. He didn't win the election. But it's an interesting question. I mean, if you accept it, why should it really be an option? So that is an interesting position to have out there. But even in the religious Zionist world, that didn't take off very much. Okay, any final questions or comments?
I have a comment. I just want to say I have been involved in several organ donations, and the amount of respect and dignity within that OR is amazing. Also, in terms of the determining brain dead, it's carefully, you know, there is no question that is a lot of care which is taken to make certain that, in fact, this has happened before anything goes on. So I don't think people should worry that it's going to be a case where someone, they're taking an organ from a live person. The technology we have today.
Yeah, so I agree with you, Faye, in general. I mean, that is, by the way, a common barrier for people donating, not just amongst Jews, that people are afraid that some background noise, guys. I hope you can hear me. But people are afraid that the testing, you know, isn't being done properly. I think in general, I have a lot of confidence in what's going on about the testing. There are different criteria. There are certain different, in different states and different countries, there are different tests that are used. And so, you know, but if this ever comes up, I mean, that's why we have a whole hotline. People can reach us. And if it ever comes up and, you know, people need a call, and we're happy to go through with the doctors to make sure, you know, they've dotted the I's and crossed the T's, just to make sure everyone, you know, feels comfortable and make sure that that test has been done. But the testing for respiratory brain death has only improved over the last 30 years also. It's got much more sophisticated, which is a good thing.
Assisted suicide will still be able to donate. If people who sign the assisted, who go through it, can they still donate?
So there are definitely cases of euthanasia. It's almost always in case of euthanasia, and not with assisted suicide. You have to understand why. In order to make organ donation possible, it's really got to be in a controlled environment. It's very orchestrated. Now, if euthanasia is done in, let's say, a hospital setting, let's take a case of someone, let's say, has Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS. And so at an earlier stage, they say, okay, you know, I want to have euthanasia done. But because they're relatively healthy still, parts of their body is still relatively healthy, organ donation, the state of their organs might be in good enough situation in order to also allow for organ retrieval. So that's definitely a phenomenon which is going on. And I mentioned Canada, but in Holland and the Netherlands as well. So it is possible in those cases to have organ donation. I have a lot of qualms about it because if you're allowing euthanasia organ donation, you've entirely eliminated the dead donor rule. Now, these are people that are very alive, right? And they're not imminently dying or anything like that. And so you've basically said, we're going to allow people to end their life in an orchestrated way in order to save someone else's life. And I'm not saying people are evil or anything like that. I get this is a complicated issue, a sensitive issue, but it really, you've totally eliminated the dead donor rule when you're allowing for that, which may not be wrong. And we're going to discuss that next week. Maybe that's not wrong, but it raises a whole slew of issues,
Do you think that a voluntary donation of kidneys as some to an unknown recipient Do you think that unknown recipient may be a non-Jew?
So I don't, it's definitely possible. I mean, most of the cases in the Jewish community today where people are donating altruistically are being done to other members of the Jewish community. But there are times you certainly can go to, you know, there's a national organ registry now, which is encouraging live donors. And you can donate to a non-Jew. And I have no issues with donating a lot non-Jew. I mean, life's a life. To save lives.
You think it doesn't matter?
I don't think it matters. No, I just all human beings are created in the image of God. It definitely is. I would speculate that one of the barriers sociologically for sometimes for people to donate posthumously is also they wonder, who's getting the organ. Could be that's a factor. I don't know. It's hard to prove that one way or the other. But I personally have no issues with that at all.
Thank you.
Okay. I think my voice is maxed out now, and I look forward to seeing everyone next week.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I tell you just one thing? You use the word criteria as a singular, and in fact it's plural. The word you should be using is criterion.
Criterion, yes, you are correct. Please. I appreciate it.
Oh, I didn't even get that. Oh, please.
I care about grammar, so it's okay. I appreciate you like saying. All right.
That's not a pagam on your fantastic Dvar Torah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for an excellent class.
Refuah Shleima, Rabbi Brody. Thanks for coming, everyone. We'll see you next week.